Tonight, we have the real deal. I think when you listen to Michael Parenti, you're going to be very impressed by what he has to say about United States culture, especially the actions that our government participates in, often without our knowledge. He's been a voice for justice. He's been a voice for peace. He's been a voice for human rights, not just in the United States, but globally. He has his doctorate degree, his PhD in political science from Yale University. He has taught at a number of colleges in the United States, and he has written 19 books with titles like Super Patriotism, Inventing Reality, Make-Believe Media, and all of these books have been used on our campus. At dinner, he was telling us about his book, The Assassination of Julius Caesar, which these days is his favorite. And you might want to check that out. Michael Parenti's also written over 250 scholarly articles. Tonight, he's going to talk to us about empire and democracy. And those are two very, very important concepts. Many of us in the United States don't like to hear that word empire. It's hard for us to think that our country may be an empire, like the old Roman Empire. Lots of us also like to talk about democracy, even though we see so many examples in front of us that suggest that maybe we don't have as much of a democracy as we think that we do. So Michael Parenti will clarify these concepts for us tonight. So without any further ado, let's give it up for Michael Parenti.
Well, I was looking at the literature on empire, you know, and I found a rather interesting thing. That there's an enormous disparity between what empires actually do and how they're represented in history by their leaders, by their chroniclers, and even by a lot of historians. The treatment of empires is really rather celebratory. For instance, empires are considered to be creators of peace. You actually have terms that indicate this. You have the term Pax Romana, and that was the Roman peace. Pax Britannica, and we even hear of Pax Americana. In fact, Ronald Steele wrote a book called Pax Americana. I mean, he was ironic about it. But there's the idea that empires are creations of peace. They're purveyors of peace. Empires also represented as bringing stability, justice, prosperity. The Romans were big on this. The Romans talked about how Rome brings security and prosperity and equality to all its subjects and brings the benefits of Roman law. The British Empire was big on talking about how they brought the benefits of civilization, the white man's burden, how the Brits would go into different parts of the world and uplift these people who obviously didn't know how to live until the British got there. Edward Gibbon, a great scholar of empire whose magnum opus is called The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire, Edward Gibbon, he wrote as follows, and I'll read to you. He said, "The obedience of the Roman world was uniform, voluntary, and permanent. The vanquished nations, blended into one great people, resigned the hope, nay, even the wish, of resuming their independence. The vast Roman Empire was governed by absolute power under the guidance of virtue and wisdom." Yeah, right. You know, it's not a word here about an empire of shattered armies, sacked towns, raped women, burned crops, enslaved prisoners of war, oppressively overtaxed populations. Not a word there about that sort of thing. Empires are sometimes also represented as being unintentional. That's even more amusing. They're the products of unconscious circumstance. When I was a youth, I always heard that the British Empire was put together in a fit of absent-mindedness. Does anybody else remember that? Cyril Robinson, a British historian, says the same thing about ancient Rome. the Roman Empire. He says it was perhaps almost as true of Rome as of Great Britain that she acquired her world domination in a fit of absence of mind. We hear the same thing. About the British Empire. John Morley, English political leader and writer, talking about the British Empire, 1877. We have had imposed upon us, the unlucky prowess of our ancestors, that is, their tremendous powers, but so unfortunate for us. The task, I want to deconstruct this as I go along, because it's a phenomenal quote. The task of ruling millions of alien dependents. They're dependents of ours. See, they depend on us. We undertake it with a disinterestedness and execute it with a skill of administration to which history supplies no parallel. Yeah, right. Again, we even hear it today about the United States in somewhat a different idiom. The Economist, August 2003, here's the quote, empires are born in funny ways and sometimes via the law of unintended consequences by accident. And this is so with the American Empire. So, people write the stuff, they believe it, you see. We often hear how the United States was reluctantly thrusted into the role of world leader. Leaders just didn't want them, but they just had to assume this position. And it's never said who did the thrusting. Well, I want to point out that, in fact, empires are the products of deliberate manipulation, deliberate confection and contrivance, and very strenuous effort. You don't just stumble upon an empire. You've got to build it with force and power and planning and ruthlessness and blood. That's what you build an empire on. Empires are built on blood. You kill, you conquer, you pillage. That's what you do. Emphasis especially on that last word, pillage. Now, we Americans have been taught to think that empire and imperialism are something that other countries do. When I was in the sixth grade in PS 85 in New York City, in Manhattan on 100, and I was born and raised on an island, I just realized the other day, called Manhattan, it's an island, 117th Street, Grace A. Myers, my teacher, we had a big map of the United States. And in the corners of the map are inserts, and there was a picture of Alaska, Hawaii, Puerto Rico, Guam. it really dates me. They weren't states yet. And we said, "What are Miss Myers? What are all these? Are these our colonies?" Because we had learned about, we passingly heard about British and French colonies in Africa and such. And she said, our country does not have colonies. We have possessions, or territories, they're called. So, oh, colonies are something that the wicked Europeans did, but not the good Americans. And that denial that we did not have an empire, that denial was made all the more persuasive because the Americans were among the earliest practitioners of what has been come to known as neo-colonialism or neo-imperialism. See, imperialism is the practice of empire. If you support and you build an empire, you're an imperialist. Well, as early as 1905, the American leadership went to Cuba, for instance. We conquered Cuba, and they said to the Cubans, look, you know, we stole you fair and square from the Spaniards in a war they didn't even want to fight, but we pushed them into it, so we have an excuse to grab not only Cuba, but the Philippines and Guam and Puerto Rico. But it doesn't look good for us to have a colony. So we're going to give you your independence. Comprende? Independencia. You're going to get your independence. You can have your own flag. It's going to be red, white, and blue. But you get only one star because you're just a little island, you know. And you have your own presidente. You're going to have your own money. You don't have to put George Washington on it. You can put, you know, Jose Marti, whoever you want. We're flex on that. And you have your own army, the Guardia Civile, your civil guard, and we'll train and equip and pay them. And so it's all yours. You're independent now. You don't have to fight us like you have to fight the Spaniards and all that. And all we want for ourselves, we'll just own your sugar industry, your tobacco industry, your nickel mining industry, your oil refineries, and we'll control all your imports and exports. And we'll control all third nation relations. Any relations you have with other nations, you got to clear it with us. And if you can't keep civil order, we have a clause here where we can come intervene anytime with the Marines to straighten things out for you. So now you're independent. That's called neo-imperialism, where you give the country the accoutrements of independence, and all you do is you control their economy. Because as de Tocqueville once said, is that the investor, the financier, the capitalist doesn't really want to own other places and people, they just want to profit off them and be able to expropriate value from them. So, in recent years, Grace A. Myers having long passed from the scene, in recent years, it's become acceptable to describe the American empire as an empire. Now remember, the United States has about 700 substantial military bases all around the world. 700. There's no country in the history of humanity who had that. And about 50 different nations. 50 nations. U.S. fleets patrol the seas all over, every ocean in the world. U.S. planes fly the skies. U.S. satellites comb every inch of the land. Of the planet. There's got to be a reason for all this sort of thing. U.S. investments are everywhere and still growing. When I wrote a book called Against Empire back in 1995, a couple of people did comment, Parenti, aren't you going too far against empire? It was a critique of U.S. policy. Why didn't you call it Against U.S. Foreign Policy? Yeah, a real snoozer that would have been. I said, well, it is an empire, you know. I said, look at the book. And today, everybody's writing a book about empire. Sorrows of Empire, The Follies of Empire, the Return of Empire, Son of Empire, I don't know. But all sorts of titles, all referring to the U.S. Now, even conservatives, I noticed, are beginning to use the term. And that's a very interesting development. You can go to the some of the talk shows, even on Fox and such, and they'll talk about it. They'll brag about it. That is, having the power gives them a sense of entitlement. You'll hear, we're the strongest nation in the world, and we have every right to act as such. We're an empire with all the obligations and opportunities and responsibilities of empire, and we better get used to it. So it's actually, the word is actually getting expropriated by the imperialists themselves to legitimate their imperialism, to legitimate their going in. We have to maintain our credibility as a great power. Henry Kissinger's been saying that for 30 years. You can't get him on a TV thing where he doesn't talk about America's credibility. America, we must maintain our show, our strength, so nobody will. I said, everybody's going to doubt and say, oh, America's pussy, oh, they're a weak little country, oh, they're another Luxembourg, oh, they didn't go in and bomb and kill and destroy this country, oh, man, we're going to kick their ass, yeah, Canada will come right down, swooping down on us if we don't maintain our credibility. We must beat them in hockey. So, we are then imperialists. The communists used to call us imperialists all the time, and who knew it? They were right. Imperialism, as I said, is the process of empire. Now, there's another interesting question as I look through the literature of empire, and that is, it's almost never asked, why are there empires? You can read whole volumes on the Roman Empire, Gibbon's masterpiece. Doesn't ever really deal with the question of why. Why the empires? You can read accounts of the Mughal Empire and how Genghis Khan conquered here and then he conquered there and he went here. Why? Why do they do that? People just like to ride roughshod over other people? Or what are empires for? You just usually assume that's just what empires do. Is it all just power for power's sake? No, it isn't. Rarely is it power for power's sake. Of course, there are individuals in pursuit of gratifying their egos who will seek power at almost any price and such. But rarely, really, can you explain whole class formations, whole national formations, or whole imperial formations as just merely the sake of pursuing power. Power is, for the most part, an instrumental value. Power is sought because people have interests that they want to maximize and enjoy and secure and advance, and they need the power to do this. So what is an empire? The real function, the substance of empire, is that there are real material interests at stake. Plunder, tribute, resources, markets, expropriating the land, the crops, the cheap labor, or in the case of ancient Rome, the slave labor. Empires are enormously profitable, mostly for the ruling class of the imperial nation. Empires are enormously costly in material loss and blood, sweat, tears, misery, death for the colonized peoples, and even for the people of the imperial nation. So you should look at an empire not exclusively as a national entity, but as a class entity. So when you say, look at the pattern of imperialism, look what the French did in Algeria and Indochina, look what the Germans did in Southwest Africa, look what the Americans did in Latin America, in Central America, in so many places. Look what the Italians did in Libya and Ethiopia. Look at what the Dutch did in the East Indies. Look at what the Portuguese did in Mozambique and other places. And look what the British did everywhere else, from India to Ireland to Egypt. make it understood that it wasn't the British, and it wasn't the Portuguese, and it wasn't the Italians as such. The ordinary people of these countries did not want to go off to these desolate places to get themselves killed. It was the ruling interests in these countries who saw opportunities for plunder, who saw opportunities for profit. When my grandfather came here, Giuseppe Parenti, he was very unhappy. He missed Italy. I said, Grandpa, if you missed Italy so much, why did you move to New York? I could have been on the Via Veneto in Rome or something instead of here in East Harlem. He said, well, I didn't want to die in Tripoli. I said, what are you talking about, Grandpa? Die in Tripoli? What do you mean? I was only a kid, about 15. He said, the press gang, he described, he was a farm laborer. And the press gangs were coming along and taking these sturdy farmer sons and putting them in the army. This was 20 years before Mussolini. This was the Italian Republic doing this, and going off to Libya to go and kill half the population of Libya. And he had no fight with anybody in Libya, so he couldn't see the sense of doing that. So Grandpa was a draft dodger, for which I'm very proud to come to descend from draft dodgers, especially if he's dodging a war, an unjust, murderous war. So it's not the Americans, what they're doing in this country or that, or the Germans or the French and such. It's the dominant interest in that country. If anything, the common people of these countries are themselves also among the victims. It's their taxes that are used to raise the armies. It's their sons and brothers and now daughters and such who go in and pay the price in blood. So the empire feeds off the republic's resources. The people end up doing without essentials so that the patricians can pursue their far-off plunder. Athens is starved so that Sparta can be fed. And you see that very same thing happening today. You see, for instance, an estimated 200 to 250 billion is going to be spent on Iraq. Meanwhile, the Republican Congress is proposing about 300 billion in cuts in human services, in public services, in health care, in aid to public education, and the like. Every time they raise your tuitions, you're paying for the cost of empire. Every time they cut federal funds to the state of Wisconsin, you have to make up the difference. Everywhere I go, I do a lot of lecturing around in various places. And when I pick up the local newspapers, it often seems like the same paper. Every paper has the same story for a while. Back during when the fiscal year was ending, it'll say state facing huge deficit, city council voting cuts in budget, cuts, layoffs, layback cuts, rollbacks, blah, blah. And so that is the cost of empire. What happens then is our economic democracy is under attack. Not everybody, as I say, pays the cost. Some people profit immensely. There's a few giant oil cartels that are now getting hundreds of millions of gallons of oil, no longer have to buy it from Saddam Hussein. They just get it straight from this government at a token price now, and they from this puppet government, and they can market it at tremendous profit. There are other companies like Halliburton and Bechtel who are there with hundreds of millions of dollars in $3, $4, $5 billion contracts, which the Government Accountability Office has just pointed out that upwards of one-third to one-half of these monies are unaccountable. Nobody knows where they went, who got the money. The Pentagon itself admits the same. They don't know where it went and who got it. You can say, well, but it ensures a fuel supply for us. We'll get that oil and we'll get gasoline for our cars and we'll have fuel for our houses. George Bush is looking out for us. Doesn't want to see our whole economy will fall apart. It runs on oil and fuel. It needs those things. No, that's false. That is outrightly false because, in fact, these countries were more than eager to sell it to us. That's what the Ayatollah Khomeini said when Iran grabbed its oil fields. And he said, what are you going to do with the oil? What are you going to do with the oil? He said, we'll sell it to you. We can't drink it. What else do you think we're going to do with it? Of course we want access to the American market. In fact, it was the other way around. It's not that Saddam Hussein was going to withhold the oil. It's that the first Gulf War that started in 91 when Bush Sr. attacked Iraq. It was over the fact that Saddam Hussein wanted a larger oil quota of the market. He wanted to be able to sell more, and they didn't want him to sell it because this would have brought oil prices down. There was a glut of oil on the market in 91, and the goal was to keep Iraqi oil off that market. So empires aren't created by absent-minded professors or politicians or policymakers. Empires are created by people who have very real calculations in mind. And that's been the same with Venezuela or Libya, all of them. They're all willing to sell, more than willing to sell their oil to the American market. But isn't it so much better than rather than buying their oil, you can own it yourself? Not you. I mean Exxon and Mobil and British Petroleum and those guys. Now, empires never stand naked in their rapacity and in their violent injustice. They invert reality. They don't say, we go to take and plunder. They say, we go to give. As I told you, the British said, the white man's burden, we go to give and bring them civilization. We hear that today. We go to give Iraq. We're going to give them, show them how to do democracy. They never tell you. There's not one single policymaker in Washington who will tell you. There's not one single media commentator or pundit or talk show host who will tell you that, in fact, Iraq had a democracy in 1965. They had a democratic revolution. And they kicked out the British. And they kicked out the British oil company owners. And they kicked out the American oil company owners. And they took over and they owned that oil themselves. And they nationalized their whole economy. They never tell you that the man they're putting on trial now, the demon who they used to justify the attack against Iraq, Saddam Hussein, this wicked, cruel Saddam Hussein, they never tell you that they put him in power. They never tell you that in 1970, Saddam Hussein committed his first act of assassination as a CIA operative. And that when he came in as head of the Ba'athist Party, he exterminated every constitutionalist, every progressive, every reformer, every Democrat in that country, or drove them underground or into exile. They don't tell you that. And they don't tell you that when he was doing that, he was Washington's poster boy. They loved him. They gave him aid. They gave him weapons of mass destruction. They gave him bacteriological warfare stuff that he used against the Iranians. They just leave it all out. And he did. He killed. And when he was at his worst, when he did most of his torturing and his murdering, that's when he was Washington's baby. That's when he was their boy. That's when they gave him aid and they cheered him on and they talked about him as pro-West and pro-American and a sturdy ally of ours who's bringing stability to Iraq. All those buzzwords, stability, which in fact was right-wing repression. That's what it was. And he only became a problem when he turned out not to be a comprador leader. A comprador leader in imperialism or in neo-imperialism is someone who heads a country and says, come on in, boys, it's all yours. Opens the country wide open to the investors. The natural resources of this country are for you to take. The labor in this country is for you to exploit. The markets of this country are for you to monopolize. It's all yours, boys. Come on in. Just give me a cut. Give my brother Jose a cut and build up our army. We'll keep them in line and make sure you back me so I can live well and piggyback off your wealth also. That's a comprador leader. And when Saddam Hussein started committing economic nationalism, saying, no, the oil isn't going to be privatized, it's going to belong to Iraq. And when he started keeping some of the same public economy that the revolution had had, with some health clinics and this and that, and where the whole economy of Iraq was and is publicly owned, so that's the foundation of lies upon which imperialist policy is based. They represent themselves as giving, when in fact they're taking. They represent themselves as virtuous when in fact they're acting like and they're backing gangsters in many cases. They represent themselves as helping the people of these various countries when in fact they victimize the people. And of course they're puzzled. And you get these American soldiers in Iraq who believe the official line from Washington and are genuinely puzzled and express it and says, these people don't want us here. We've come to try to help them, but they don't want our help. We don't understand what it is. don't understand what it is. What's the matter with them? Why are they being so unreasonable? And it kind of breaks your heart, because you got these young Americans putting their lives on the line, creating more enemies and wanting to do some good things for people, because they've been told these people needed these good things and they needed to be taught how to do democracy and that sort of thing. The imperialists also play upon our patriotic pride. They tell us, and this has been part of our political culture, that we Americans are a unique people, and that our country has a unique and marvelous history, that there's been no country in the world like the United States. And that's absolutely true. It does have a remarkable history. And it's also true of many other countries, that they're all very remarkable and unique and have incredible histories. The history of Ireland is incredible, a history of courage and oppression and fighting off for independence. The history of Britain, of France, of Spain, of China, of India, of Italy, of Brazil, of you can go on, South Africa. I mean, the histories they have, the glorious, the horrors, the atrocities, the crimes, the glories, the wonderful things that have happened, the admirable cultures, the less than admirable things and such. It's all human endeavor. And all these countries, many of them think that they were exceptional. You look at the French nationalists in the early 19th century. Michelet, read his writings, and he talks about how nothing has meaning, nothing reaches a world stage until it gets to France, and specifically Paris, which in a way was true. And the language of diplomacy throughout Europe, the language of ruling classes, the Polish ruling class, the Russian ruling class, they all spoke French. French was the lingua franca, so to speak. It's an interesting pun there. You can go back as far as the Old Testament, and you hear about the Israelites and the chosen people and God ordaining them on the mission and such. The Roman Empire, the Romans were sure they were gods, the gift of the gods to the rest of the world. The British, of course, the British Empire, nobody had a mission in the world like us. Rule Britannia, Britannia rule the seas. We were here to do this special mission for all the world. You can read the Indian nationalists, the Indian National Congress in New Delhi back in 1870s or so, talking about the Aryan mission that we were on to uplift and unify India, and not only just India, but the whole world, to be an example and lead the whole world away from the crass materialism of the West to a higher spiritual world and existence. The Italian nationalist, Gioberti, who talked about the Italians as the new chosen people, or more important than him was Mazzini, Giuseppe Mazzini, who talked about the third great resurgence of Rome. First there was ancient Rome, then there was Rome of the Vatican, and now a unified Italy will bring democracy and liberty to peoples all over the world. And the average Italian, of course, was like my grandpa, just trying to survive and didn't know about Mazzini's dreams. But there was a movement around Mazzini, you know. They believed this sort of thing. The Russian nationalists and Slavic, pan-Slavic nationalists, Dostoevsky writing these things about Holy Mother Russia leading the world, having some special history and mystery and repository of virtue, and will bring the world into a whole new era, you see, and revitalize the world and teach it new lessons and new spirituality. The German nationalists like Treitschke and Fichte, who talked about German Macht and how German power would be used and not restrained, and that were a little less benign than Mazzini and Dostoevsky and Michelet. But even there, the underlying mission was really be example and straighten up everybody else and to live a better life, and Germany, that was going to be Germany's mission. So Americans are very unexceptional in thinking that they're so exceptional. Everybody thinks they're exceptional. Everybody thinks they're the cat's meow. They're God's gift to humanity. Rulers, of course, also play upon our not only our patriotic pride. We should be proud as Americans. I'm proud to be an American. Go out there and bomb that and hit Fallujah with everything you've got for good old USA. Not only do they play upon our pride, but they play upon our fears. And that's become a very potent way of rallying support for interventions, which most Americans, by the way, do not support. Let me tell you that in November of 1990, when George Bush Sr., the first George Bush, started the first war against Iraq, the Gulf War, you remember when he bombed Iraq and drove Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait and all that, public opinion polls showed 70, 75%, 80% of the people opposed to any military venture were not sure, or preferring diplomatic means of resolving the conflict. They did not want to send American troops and American guns off to Iraq. They didn't even know where the hell Iraq was. They didn't understand what this had to be, why this had to be. And then in November, I remember I tracked it. I think I even wrote it up. I can't remember which book it's in, but I tracked it. In November of 1990, there was a poll taken, and the poll said, if Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons — the term weapons of mass destruction had not quite yet come into vogue — it said, if Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons and might threaten to use them, do you think this would justify taking military action against them to prevent it? And then the percentages went from 70% against the war to 70 plus percent for it. After that, all we heard was that Saddam Hussein had nuclear weapons. And Bush was going to go in there and disarm him and take it over, which he never did. He just drove him out of Kuwait and slaughtered his army and all that, but never went into Iraq himself, which raised the question, well, if this guy is such a maniac and has all these weapons and is out to kill us, why didn't we get rid of him then? And why did, for the next 10 years, he live there in peace and didn't bother us when he had this chance to have us in the crosshairs and he could have whacked us and didn't? So, but they play upon your fear, you see. I'm going to read you some quotes. This one I have it in The Assassination of Julius Caesar. It's by a conservative economist by the name of Joseph Schumpeter. And I think Schumpeter was an Austrian. And he wrote this in 1919 about ancient Rome. Rome pursued that policy which pretends to aspire to peace, but unerringly generates war. The policy of continual preparation for war. The policy of meddlesome interventionism. There was no corner of the known world where some interest was not alleged to be in danger or under actual attack. If the interests were not Roman, they were those of Rome's allies. And if Rome had no allies, then allies would be invented. The fight was always invested with an aura of legality. Rome was always being attacked by evil-minded neighbors, always fighting for a breathing space. The whole world was pervaded by a host of enemies, and it was manifestly Rome's duty to guard against their aggressive designs. They were enemies who only waited to fall upon the Roman people. Does any of that sound familiar at all? John Foster Dulles. John Foster Dulles was a rich corporate lawyer in New York. He and his brother Alan Dulles were both rich lawyers. They worked for, what's the firm? Sullivan and Cromwell. Now, Harriman wasn't one of them? They worked for Sullivan Cromwell, big firm. Alan Dulles went on to become director of the CIA, and John Foster Dulles became Secretary of State under Dwight Eisenhower. And this is what he wrote afterwards, after he had been Secretary of State. In order to bring a nation to support the burdens of maintaining great military establishments, It is necessary to create an emotional state akin to war psychology. There must be the portrayal of external menace. This involves the development to a high degree of the nation hero and the nation villain, the ideology of heroes and villains, and the arousing of the population to a sense of sacrifice. Once these exist, we have gone a long way on the path to war. So what you have here is imperial mythology in the service of class power. The rulers drag the people along into a war which is against their interests, against the interests of the people in these other countries, and they do this by playing on their pride and on their fear. There was a statement made by Osama bin Laden, and it gets kind of sad when Osama bin Laden sounds better than your own president. There was a statement he made in November 2004, just before the election. He said, don't expect Bush or Kerry, either of them, to save you. We are not waging a war against you. You have been waging a war against us for decades. You have come into the Middle East and you have expropriated our resources. You have undermined our cultures. You have corrupted our youth. You've done all these things. We are fighting back. That's what September 11 was about. And you could save yourself by changing your direction. Our fight now is not a war of aggression against you. It's a retaliation against your aggression. This is what he was saying. You go back to the terrorists who attacked the World Trade Center 10 years before it was finally demolished on September 11, 2003. Go back to 1993. Those guys planted these huge vans filled with explosions in the sub-basement, in the garages under the World Trade Center, and they blew up, and they injured about 100 people and killed about 18. It didn't bring down the Trade Center as they was hoping. They're all in jail now. They published a letter in the New York Times, why we did it. They said, we did it because you have been destroying us. And it's not us Americans. It's the transnational corporate investors who go into countries to keep them impoverished, to plunder their markets, their resources, and their labor, and to keep them poor. The poorer and hungrier I can keep you, the harder you will work for less. The harder you work for less, the more I get. And that's the trouble with my own workforce here in America. And that's why I close down the factories here and I go off to Indonesia, where instead of having to pay you $20 an hour, I can pay you 15 cents an hour in Indonesia. Instead of worrying about pensions and retirement benefits and disability insurance and paid vacations and all those other things, every dollar I got to spend on all those kind of stupid, unnecessary things is one less dollar I put in my pocket. And capitalism works better in Indonesia, in the Congo, in Nigeria, in Guatemala. It works better in those countries than it does in Denmark and Germany and France. Every dollar you invest as a capitalist in Denmark, you get back maybe 2.5 or something. Every dollar you invest in Indonesia, you get back 15. It cost me $7 to make Nike shoes in Indonesia. I bring all the resources and everything else, and I can bring them back to the U.S. and sell them for $200 and $250. And you tell me why I should stay in Wisconsin. So there goes our economic democracy that we have been fighting for. But this is what we're talking then here is not about nations against nations. It's class against class. It's a class exploiting its own working class and the working class abroad, playing one off against the other, preaching to their own class and saying, you see how hard they're working? You're going to have to work just as hard. You're going to have to work just as hard as the Indians and the Chinese. They put in the Chinese in the free business zones. They put in 12-hour days, 7 days a week. You're going to have to learn to do the same thing. We can not only say goodbye to the welfare state, we can say goodbye to all human services, we can say goodbye to all economic democracy, and that means, in a sense, saying goodbye to democracy itself. Because the function of democracy is not just to elect people. It's not just to hold elections. No one ever doubted the ability of this country to hold elections. We have elections for president, for senate, for congress, for state legislature, state assembly, state senate, city council, county supervisors, dog catchers, board of education. We got elections coming out of our ears. We got more elections than you count. But democracy also has to have not only these procedures and not only these rights, which are important rights, the right to assemble and the right to speak freely and such, but democracy should have a substance to it. That it's got to be a democracy for what? What's the use of having all these democratic procedures when, in fact, it doesn't help the people? So the outcomes, there have to be material outcomes. There has to be a substantive democracy as well as a procedural democracy. And this is, at times, what is missing. Well, and it's hard, I know, because the Republican Party has become increasingly disciplined, increasingly centralized, increasingly homogenized, increasingly beholden to a right-wing reactionary Christian fundamentalism and corporate America. And the Democratic Party has been wishy-washing around and doesn't know what quite hit it and plays by a different set of rules, expects comity, reciprocity, and doesn't understand they're facing a bunch of guys who will stop at nothing, who will try anything, who will use any lie, any ploy, any kind of thrust to win and maintain and maximize power to serve corporate America. That's a Democratic. You know when people say to me, well, do you support the Democratic Party? I say, when you have good progressives in the Democratic Party, like a John Conyers, or like my congressman back in Berkeley, Vermont, Barbara Lee, congresswoman, I support them, and I think it's wrong to run a third-party effort against really progressive people who want to change a lot of these things. But much of the Democratic Party is a terrible disappointment. Whenever people ask me about the Democrats, I remember Oscar Wilde. I always think of Oscar Wilde. When Oscar Wilde came to America to visit, people said, oh, you must go up to Niagara Falls and look at Niagara Falls. It's one of the great wonders of the world. It's just marvelous. So Oscar Wilde went up to Niagara. He came from England, you know. He was just always wisecracking with these clever remarks and all that. And a playwright, a poet. He went up to, all the way up New York State, he went up to Niagara Falls. He took one look at it and he said, Niagara Falls is the second greatest disappointment that American brides experience on their honeymoon. And that's the way I feel about the Democratic Party. It's the second greatest disappointment I experienced after the Republicans, of course. It doesn't mean you can't work in the system, but you could also work outside and pressure it. You try to do whatever you can to educate, organize, agitate. Remember, in the 20th century, we fought very hard. And we got rural electrification, we got an extension of public education, we got public higher education, which they're now privatizing. Tony tells me that more than half of your tuition, more than half of your education costs are now back as a tuition cost. So that's a creeping privatization. They've in effect de facto privatized what are great public institutions. We have fought and we got a shorter work day. We got retirement pensions. We got disability insurance. These are all very important democratic gains, small d. They are gains for the democracy. They give democracy a substance. Because people can be democratic citizens when they are educated, when they're fed, they can better defend their interests, organize themselves, and the like. If you're torn apart and you're fighting to try to keep body and soul together, it's very hard to be doing things. So democracy is very much tied up with with empire. The goals of empire are to put a lock, and it's not me who says it. You can go to the Projects for New American Century. And the Project for a New American Century has it written right there, Rebuilding America's Defenses. And it says, the goal is to get a global lock on all the resources of the world. We, America, have an unprecedented opportunity to get a lock and monopoly on all the resources of the world. And we have, and we can act as the only superpower and no one else has it. Oh, come on now. What conspiracy theory is this? No conspiracy theory. It's right on the internet. You can go Google Project for New American Census and read it. They say this is what they had. Well, who are these people? Just another right-wing think tank. Yeah, not just another one. They had Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Donald Rumsfeld, John Bolton, all the people who are in the Bush administration right now. And this is their goal. They said they would do this. The Downing Street memo shows that well before September 11, they were talking about invading Iraq. And we've got to get an invasion going in Iraq. So, my friends, I'm saying that our democracy is under siege from the empire. And to save the democracy, we've got to get rid of the empire. Well, do you really think that U.S. rulers are targeting these countries to just undo their public services and reforms and regulations and plunder their environment and natural resources and monopolize their markets? Well, yeah, that's what they're doing in our own country. That's their agenda here. They're plundering our resources. They're undoing public services. They're cutting back on all these very things. The goal is the third worldization of everywhere. Iraq was, before the 91 Gulf War, Iraq was the most prosperous country in the Middle East. Whatever else you want to say about Saddam Hussein, Iraq had, there are countries in the Middle East that have oil with no water. There are others that have water with no oil. Iraq had oil, it had water, it had a wonderful agricultural base also. It had the highest standard of living in the Middle East, which may not be that great, but it was pretty good. It was pretty good by Middle East standards. Today, it's probably the most ravaged, most destitute, most desperate country, along with Haiti maybe, of all 180 countries in the world. It's down at the bottom. So what we must do is organize, speak out, reach others, build a grassroots and impact upon our rulers. Let me end by reading you just one more thing, if I may. Let's help the Cubans against the ruthless Spaniards. And what did McKinley first do? What was his first act of war? He sent a fleet all the way across the Pacific to the Philippines with an army. It was the first time in American history that an American president had sent an army off the shores of the United States, that is transoceanically. And he engaged in a five-year war in the Philippines, very bloody, killing several hundred thousand, estimates vary, several hundred thousand of the Philippines to conquer this very rich archipelago and to form this world, this beginning of a global empire. So the Spanish War came, and the American public was hyped with it, and they were told that we got to go fight the Spaniards, we got to go help the Cubans, rah rah, and the flag was waving and all that sort of thing. And this is what Tom Watson wrote while the war was still in progress. He said, "The blare of the bugle has drowned the voice of the reformer." The Populist Party was finished. Their reforms and all that were just all forgotten about, because now it was war, war, war. And we're going to be a great power. Watson goes on, he says, "Who gets the benefit of this war? The bond seekers, the capitalists, the railroads. National bankers will profit by this war. The new bonds give them the basis for new banks, and their power is prolonged. The privileged classes all profit by this war. It takes the attention of the people off economic issues and perpetuates the unjust system they have put upon us. Politicians profit by the war. It buries issues they dare not meet. What do the people get out of this war? The fighting and the taxes." He wrote this in 1898. What is the United States doing in this war with Spain in the first place? True, Spain is oppressing Cuba, but so is England oppressing Ireland, Egypt, and India. France is oppressing Siam and Madagascar. Turkey is oppressing Armenia. Should we then take up arms against the oppressors of the world? We would more likely end by becoming oppressors ourselves. The Spaniards and Cubans were bushwhacking one another and killing from 3 to 5 men at a battle. We have gone down there and killed more people in 3 months than they would have killed in 13 years. If they were starving before, who feeds them now? What are we going to get out of this war as a nation? Endless trouble, complications, expense. Republics cannot go into the conquering business and remain republics. Militarism leads to military domination, military despotism. Imperialism smooths the way for the emperor. And as you know, inside every president, there's an emperor that's trying to get out. And our job is to stuff that emperor right back down his throat or up whatever orifice is coming out of. Okay, thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen. Well, I just said there's, I would hope from this analysis you understand there's no one solution. That question's asked all the time. Obviously, there's no one magic solution. I said organize, agitate, educate, and try to build a counter-consciousness and counter-ideology. All governments, to some extent, all governments rest on public opinion, to some extent or another. Don't for a minute think that your rulers don't care what you think. Oh my gosh, do they care? Oh my gosh, are they listening all the time? Oh my gosh, do they have an ear down to the national pulse? Don't for a minute think that they don't respond. It's not that they're such Democrats that they'll respond because we have to be democratic and representative. That's not why they respond. They respond because they understand power, and they know where their power ultimately comes from. It comes off your shoulders, out of your purses, and out of your minds. And if they can control your minds, they can control you, and they can sit on your shoulders and keep their hands in your pockets, in your purses. So that's what you got to do. Do everything you can. What I do is I go on demonstrations, I write letters, I call up policymakers, and of course all my writing and my speaking is part of my work. But that's what you can do. We have very few democratic powers, but the few we have, resources, the few we have, we even don't use as fully as we should, I think.
What was the Bush administration hiding in their cover-up on that?
Well, I think they were complicit. I think they looked the other way when it was happening. They knew something was coming. It's not my speculation. They said it. Condoleezza Rice said we had heard that there would be hijacking of planes, but we didn't know they would fly into buildings. And then there's also evidence indicating that they knew that some of them might fly into buildings, and they did nothing. George Bush never even alerted the airlines. And even though there are FBI agents who talked about these groups of guys who were taking flying lessons and all that, remember he was silenced or transferred or something. I